16. Nola was gone, of course. But you saw her, Roddy asked the manager of the steakhouse. In one hand, Roddy held his police badge, in the other, a photo of Nola from her old military ID.
Yep, that's her. Though the pic doesn't do her justice, the manager Marante replied, flicking the photo with his middle finger. She's hotter in real life. Angrier, too.
Did you talk to her? Zig asked.
I told her what I told the others.
Others? Marante took a long sip of his coffee, his eyes filled with a forced, cocky smirk that showed how much he liked being in charge.
Last year, one of my busboys got arrested for buying Sudafed in bulk, then grinding it up and selling it to meth heads. Cops came out once, maybe twice, to ask me questions. But in the past 2 days, the entire law enforcement carnival came to town.
From his jacket, Marante pulled out a short stack of business cards, fanning them across the table, each with a different government logo.
State police, military intelligence, army criminal investigators, two FBI guys that were actually wearing black suits, and this one local detective, a Muslim girl in full burqa.
It's not a burqa, Roddy said.
Whatever they call it.
Headscarf, Roddy insisted, flipping through the business cards, not making eye contact.
The preferred term is headscarf. Whatever, Marante said, making a face and taking another sip of coffee.
Roddy pulled out his phone and took a photo of each of the business cards.
Click. Did you know that your valet was using your customers' cars to break into their houses? You sure I can't offer you some coffee? Marante asked Zig. It's something special. We put cinnamon in it.
Mr. Marante, I asked you a quest.
Wojo was 32 years old and still parking cars. So every few months, did I get a complaint that sunglasses or an iPhone charger might be missing from a BMW? That goes with the job.
But did I think he was driving to people's homes and treating it like some Ocean's 11 sequel?
Dover Air Force Base, Roddy interrupted, holding up a business card for Zig to see. Zig didn't recognize the name, but it was clearly one of Dover's newest homicide investigators, hired by Colonel O.J. Watley, the man who, according to Will, specifically asked for Zig to be put on this case.
Sir, what else did Nola ask you about? Zig said as Roddy took a photo of the card.
Click. Nola, Marante replied. She told me her name was Camille.
I meant, she's actually,
I'm not offended, but do me a favor and spare me the bullshit, okay? I don't care what her name is. I don't care what she's up to. In this job, the majority of my clients are polished people, businessmen, judges. I know what polished looks like. Your girl's the opposite of that. She's not even really a cop, is she?
Mr. Marante, you don't trust her, do you?
I don't blame you. From the moment she walked in, she asked a few questions but kept her head down, drawing the entire time.
Roddy looked up from the business cards.
Did she draw anything in particular? Zig asked.
She asked for my pen. But she's not exactly a sharer.
From what I could tell, it kind of looked like the restaurant. Like she was drawing the whole place. Otherwise, all she cared about was the army guy. Mr. Mint.
Colonel Mint, Zig corrected. Though, again, he wasn't surprised. Half a decade ago, Nola and Mint met each other on the same assignment, or at least in the same location, a place codenamed Grandma's Pantry. Now, someone seemed to be tracking and killing the few other people who served with them.
Oh. She also wanted our security footage, Marante added.
I didn't see any cameras out front, Roddy said.
There aren't any. The owners are cheap. Only places they record are the safe in back and our wine cellar. I gave both tapes to the army investigators. You think she wanted to see Mint's interaction with your valet? Zig asked. Actually, she was asking about interior cams, like she wanted to know who Mint was meeting. Zig looked back at Roddy. It was a good question, one that Zig was already kicking himself for not asking. According to the police reports, once the valet took off, Colonel Mint jumped in a cab and followed him to Mint's house. But in all the back and forth over the deaths, they'd forgotten a key detail. People don't come to fancy steakhouses to eat alone. Mr. Marante, is it possible to take a look at your reservation book? Zig asked. Yeah, sure, of course, Marante said, putting his coffee down with enough speed that it was clear none of the other investigators had asked about it. I got it right. He reached to his left, but nothing was there. Confused, he lifted a nearby stack of menus, then his laptop, then started rummaging through his briefcase. It was just here. I had it when... He cut himself off. That bitch stole my iPad! 17. The first thing Nola did was turn off the iPad's tracking. Sure, she could have asked the steakhouse manager for a look at the reservation book, but if her hunch was right, the last thing she needed was for him to share it with others. For the rest of the 40-minute ride, Nola did what she always did during drives or long runs, composed layouts in her head. In this case, a mental drawing of Mint that she'd been working on since the funeral. Years ago, when she first drew him back at Grandma's pantry, she'd focused on the obvious: his stubborn lips, absurd jaw, and buzzed blonde hair, so crisp it looked like it was cut every hour. Same with his military uniform. When you wash camouflage too much, the shades of green take on a faded, whitish tinge. Not Mint. The moment he stepped into a room, you knew he was the commander, though Nola quickly realized it had nothing to do with his clothing or jawline. It came from the hardest thing to render, the charisma and energy that radiated off him. That very first night at Grandma's pantry, things ran so late, Nola popped into a nearby supermarket to pick up a cheap dinner. At the checkout was one of the young privates, some junior-level kid assigned to do coffee runs, who was doing the same. As the kid went to pay, the prices were clearly more than he'd calculated, so he started putting things back to lower his bill. What the kid didn't realize was that Archie Mint was in that same line. To put a finer point on it, Mint wasn't one of those pushovers who took a recruiting command to avoid the field. He'd served in the 10th Mountain Division up at Fort Drum, a hard outfit that always deployed. But on that night in the supermarket, Mint pulled out his wallet and paid the bill. The kid was embarrassed, saying thank you over and over. Mint wouldn't have it. Told him it was just between them. More important, when they got back to the office, Mint never said a word to anyone, never took credit. Nola wouldn't have even known about it if she hadn't been lurking in one of the aisles. In the military, so many commanders divided the world into O's and E's, officers and enlisted. Mint inspired loyalty because he knew there were things more important than those distinctions. The mental picture disappeared as Nola's car bucked to a stop at a black metal security gate. She entered a 4-digit code into a keypad, and the gate unclenched with a loud k-clunk. The road ahead was unpaved. She hit the gas, knowing where she was going. Finally, home. For nearly a mile, the road twisted and turned, tornadoes of dust cartwheeling behind her. Then, at the very back of the park, Nola made a sharp right into an empty service lot. Straight ahead was a dirt footpath that wove into the woods. She checked it for footprints. 2 sets. Just as she knew there would be. Psst. Psst. Nola called out, leaving the car behind. No answer. No surprise. As she started up the path, a mass of trees and brush swallowed her,
hiding her from view. Back in the early 1900s, this park, over 1,000 acres, had been a private estate that held multimillionaire Pierre Dupont's summer home. Today, 38 minutes from Mint's house, with greenhouses a mile and a half long, it was known as Longwood Gardens, the largest private botanical garden in the world, attracting over 1 million tourists a year. Here, though, at the back of the park, on the outskirts of the 86-acre meadow garden, it was abandoned.
Psst, psst. Sarah, food,
Nola called again. Still no response. Nola glanced around, noting the silence. She rechecked the path. Still, 2 sets of footprints. Up ahead, the path ended at a dilapidated white milk barn that had been abandoned decades ago and was now used for holding the park's discarded tractors, ladders, and other random equipment. On her left was her real destination, the rusted silver Airstream trailer, a 1993 25-foot Excella with a bent awning arm that made the entire blue canopy sag like a winking eye. As always, a single Tupperware bin sat on the cinder block steps. Nola's inbox.
Psst. Psst. Sarah, you there?
Nola called again, eyeing the way the Tupperware sat askew on the top step, like someone had moved it. She rechecked the dirt. 2 sets of footprints. Nothing out of place. Nola grabbed the Tupperware but didn't open it. Inside were 3 Polaroids, each one of a different plant, its name handwritten across the bottom. Ficus benjamina, a.k.a. the Dutch treat, Devalia tyramanii, the bear's foot fern, and Sansevieria, a rare snake plant with pristine white striping in the leaves. They were this week's assignments from Daryl, the head of Longwood's botanical library. For 6 months now, Nola had been painting their collection in return for room and board, though the best benefit was the solitude of living out here, in what had become her private art studio.
Sarah, if you're hiding just to piss me off,
Nola warned, carefully pulling open the door to the trailer and... On the floor, a dead toad was lying stomach up, its belly torn open.
Sss,
came a low hiss from below the kitchen table, where an angry Russian blue cat with bald patches and forehead scars sat.
Sarah Connor, did you mess up my floor?
Nola asked. The cat hissed again. Nola rolled her eyes and picked up the toad, which was really all Sarah Connor wanted. Every few days, the cat would sneak out through the hole in the window screen and bring back a new gift. Toads? Mice? Giant dragonflies? Whatever she could find.
You're a horrible cat, Nola said, tossing the toad outside.
The cat hissed, satisfied, narrowing her white milky eye that had been scratched by a fox. 3 months ago, Nola had found the cat bleeding, its paw broken and bent in a chain-link fence that it was trying to scale. No collar, no home, and clearly running from something. God, did Nola understand that? The local veterinarian said to give up on her, that the cat would be dead in a week anyway. Nola brought her back here, where Sarah Connor refused to eat for 4 days until Nola found her weakness. Buttered corn on the cob. The damn cat would do anything for that.
Sss,
the cat hissed again, scratching at the peeling linoleum floor for no reason. Nola barely noticed, pulling off her shirt to get a better look at her collarbone. Back at the funeral, when she took out the staff sergeant who tried to handcuff her, he'd stabbed one of the cuffs into her neck. Kid was quicker than he looked.
Good for him. Right instinct. Trained well,
Nola thought, pulling aside the strap of her black bra, trying to get a close-up look in the bathroom mirror. There was a little blood, but she'd be fine. Turning her attention to the iPad, she hit the power button. On screen, the logo for Barron's Steakhouse bloomed into view, along with 2 buttons. Schedules? Reservations? Nola didn't hesitate. Reservations. A calendar appeared. Today's date, then four columns. Hour, name, phone, notes. Tonight was a weeknight. The earliest reservation was at 5:30 p.m., party of three under the name A. Epstein, with a note that read, "Celebrating 75th B." Another half dozen reservations were listed below that. Nola swiped back to Saturday, the night of Mint's death. "What do you think, Sarah Connor? A middle-aged man going to a fancy steakhouse by himself?" The cat stayed silent. "Yeah, me neither," Nola said, scrolling down and doing everything in her power to not reach into her pocket and pinch the skin on her thigh. Time to see who Colonel Mint was meeting the night he died. 18. Nola scrolled through the iPad, scanning the reservation list for parties of two. According to his death certificate, Lieutenant Colonel Archie Mint died at 7:46 p.m. That meant he probably pulled up to the steakhouse somewhere between 7:15 and 7:30 p.m. Parties of two, Nola thought as she continued to scroll. 7 p.m., 7:30, 8 o'clock, 8:30. No one named Archie. No one named Mint. She started again, expanding the search to bigger parties. There were plenty of names, each in its own digital column. Bentis, Gatos, Mac, Maleev, but no Mint or anything close to it. At the top of the screen, she noticed a search box and quickly typed the name Archie. No records found. She typed the name Mint. One record found. 2 years ago, October 15th, Mint's birthday. That meant he liked this place, or used to like it. Either way, he hadn't been back, or at least made a reservation until two nights ago, when he decided he needed some steak. Most likely, he didn't plan to eat alone. Staring down at the iPad, Nola paced the length of the narrow trailer, whose walls were covered with hundreds of random pages, like a bulletin board in a student union. Postcards, magazine photos, old album covers, and sketches from her notepad. Of Nola's cat, of the milk barn, of the trailer, of every animal she'd spotted on the property, and, of course, of Longwood's open fields and native plants. There were no drawings of people, except for one sketch of Deshaun from the metal shop, and naturally, a postcard of Bob Ross painting happy little trees. Along the front wall were six finished canvases, leaning one against another, like dominoes in midfall. Sarah Connor purred, sniffing the spot where she'd left the dead toad. "It has to be in here. Check again," Nola told herself. She scrolled back to the top of the reservation list, re-scanning them one by one. That's when she saw it. Spear. That name. She knew it from years ago. That was Mint's old code name, Spear Mint. That was it, based on his favorite military saying that the best units and best leaders lived on the tip of the spear. Such macho awfulness. "But if that's you, sir." She scrolled to the right, checking the details. Spear, 7:30 p.m., party of two. Email contact was ragdog1216@hotmail.com. Ragdog? Nola didn't know what it meant. Maybe a nickname from his 10th Mountain days? Mint's official email followed the usual format, name.mil@mail.com. He had a personal one on Gmail. But if he was also using Hotmail?
You cheating on your wife, sir? Nola asked, surprised by how much the thought riled her. Mint was a decorated soldier, a good father, a loyal investigator who once risked his life for...
No, don't think it. But she had to. When it came to Archie Mint, it's all she thought. For years now.
Hey, Sarah Connor, how are your password-guessing abilities?
The cat turned away, sniffing the floor and licking it twice. Nola pulled out her phone and opened a browser, hotmail.com.
She had his username, ragdog1216.
Password? She tried a few. Each had the same result. Your password is incorrect.
Eventually, a warning appeared. You have one try remaining before we lock your account.
Something opened in Nola's chest, a sharp, aching twist. She didn't know if it was anger or pain, but right there, she wanted to put her fist into the phone's screen.
Turning back to the iPad, Nola reread the entry in the reservation book. Spear, 7:30 p.m., party of two.
It was him. Had to be him.
Replaying it again, she told herself it was probably just a work dinner. But who schedules work at 7:30 p.m. on a Saturday? More important, whoever Mint was scheduled to eat with, why didn't he or she step forward once Mint was found dead?
She studied the name. Spear. 7:30 p.m. Party of...
Nola pulled the iPad closer. She'd missed it at first. In the far right column, under Notes,
Mint's entry looked like it was blank, but it wasn't.
At the very bottom of the cell, there was tiny, light blue type, like fine print. A few other entries had it, too. She expanded the image to see it better. Most of the entries had the words Open Table, the reservation app. Two others listed Resi, also a reservation app. But Mint's entry had this. Black House.
Confused, Nola clicked on it.
Had to be a referral. If you made your reservation through Open Table, the steakhouse's system listed Open Table in your entry. Same with Resi. But as she clicked on the words Black House, a pop-up window appeared. Open in App Store?
Yes, Nola clicked.
Another window opened. The words Black House appeared in a stenciled military font.
Nola's eyes narrowed. Her stomach churned.
Sir, what the hell were you doing here?
19. Zig was thinking about the pencils.
Can I see the photo again? He asked, steering the car off the highway and blowing past the wooden sign for Wonderly Square, where nature smiles for 5 miles.
Roddy turned the tablet toward Zig, the glow lighting his face in the dark car. The photo was from outside the funeral this morning, of young, beefy Staff Sergeant Buddy Adcock curled on the ground in agony, a pen protruding from his knee. During the entire ride home, Zig had been thinking about this photo. When he first saw it, he couldn't help but stare at Buddy's face contorted in pain, at his mouth wide open in mid-scream, a spiderweb of spit forming a tightrope between his top and bottom teeth. At Buddy's knee, there was an unmistakable Rorschach blob of blood soaking through his slacks. But right now, Zig was focused on the bottom corner of the photo, the half-dozen colored pencils littered across the asphalt. Naturally, they were Nola's. She took her pencils everywhere. So for them to be scattered in such disarray, Buddy had hit her fast, caught her off guard, most likely as she was coming out of the building. It was a bad sign. As the Army's artist in residence, Nola had spent years racing into war zones. Libya, Iraq, even that massacre when ISIS beheaded those 3 Marines outside of Raqqa in Syria. She stayed alive because she wasn't easily surprised. She didn't get caught off guard. And yet, in the photo, a stray chocolate-brown pencil had bounced off the concrete path, sitting askew in the grass. A yellow pencil was right beside it. To leave her tools behind. Nola must have raced out of there at full speed, like she was scared of what else was coming. Zig had never seen her scared before, never seen her panic or make mistakes before. To anyone else, those pencils were just pencils. For Nola, who processed everything through her art, they were a lifeline. "This isn't just another case for her, is it?" Roddy asked. "There's something personal she's chasing." "Or something personal that's chasing her," Zig thought, tugging the steering wheel and trying to think of the last time Nola ran from anything. And then this thought as he stared at Roddy, that nothing was more personal than family. "Today seems like a day that if you painted it, it'd be dark red," Roddy said, taking a look out the window as they turned onto Zig's block. "You ever have that? Where a day seems like it's red, or blue, or some other color?" Okay, Roddy was obviously weird, but it was more than just being weird. Even if you put aside his awkward stare, the way he overshared, and, of course, the way he said every damn thing that came into his brain, there was still something. Zig didn't have a word for it yet, but he could feel it lurking there, like Roddy had another layer that he kept hidden. Was Zig being paranoid? Of course he was. But right now, if he wanted to keep Nola safe, his best bet was to keep Roddy close and keep an eye on him. "Mr. Zigarowski, do you know that woman?" Roddy added. "What woman?" Zig asked, again glancing down at the photo. "Not there." "There," Roddy said, pointing through the windshield up the block towards Zig's house. Zig squinted through the dark, assuming Roddy had misidentified Mr. Munoz, whose wife died last year, and who often lingered outside people's homes, hoping to make chit-chat while he was walking his dog. Zig couldn't have been more wrong. Sitting there on his front porch was a thin brunette, studying her phone like she was being quizzed on it. At just the sight of her, he hadn't seen her in a year. Maybe longer. Something needled at his throat. His rib cage clenched like a fist around his heart. Not her. Can't be. "Stop the car," Zig blurted, forgetting that he was the one driving. He hit the brakes and the car bucked. "Mr. Zigarowski, is that?" Zig wasn't listening. He was already out the door, moving in a blur, but never taking his eyes off her. "Charmaine. His ex-wife. Char, are you... Is this... Is everything okay?" he asked. It wasn't. 20. It was a game. A first-person shooting game, Nola realized as she studied the screen. Like Fortnite or Call of Duty. Though unlike in those games, the graphics here were uncanny. The digital characters looking like real people in real uniforms. Is this VR? Some sort of virtual reality training program? Nola wondered, the screen buzzing with action as digital rangers, marines. Even a group of SEALs ran through an Iraqi town, their uniforms rendered with every minute detail, from the most up-to-date camo pattern to the shoulder patches that list your blood type. "Welcome back. Enter username or email. ragdog1216@hotmail.com, Nola typed. A little hand grenade appeared, spinning round and round. Then, password? Tip of the spear. Incorrect password. Please enter password. Tip of the spear 1216. Incorrect password. Please enter password. Spear 1216. Incorrect password. Please enter password. Spear. Incorrect password. Please enter password. She thought about it a moment, then typed Spearmint. Incorrect password. Please enter password. Screw you, you shit computer! Incorrect password. Please enter password. She took a breath, closed her eyes, then typed Huck Violet. Mince kids. Incorrect password. Please enter password. Huck Violet 1216. The hand grenade appeared again. Welcome back, Spearmint. Resume session. Nola grinned. Yes. 21. On Nola's screen, the tiny grenade was still spinning. Nola took a seat on her bed, its blue sheets unmade. Fuzzy cat toys sat up by the pillows, two of them shaped like mice, one of them shaped like broccoli for some reason. A pop-up window finally appeared on screen in the online game known as Black House. Returning character already in use. Play as new character? Confused, Nola clicked yes. The screen blinked. Bright yellow letters appeared. Lieutenant Colonel Mint 04, reporting for duty. The screen blinked again, revealing a white room with walls that looked like they were made from ancient marble. On screen, Nola had a first-person view of whatever this new character, Lieutenant Colonel Mint 04, was seeing. The room looked exotic, something Persian or Indian, a church or a mosque, with peaked arch windows and sandstone carvings. The most disorienting part was the 360-degree view that kicked in as Nola turned and tilted the iPad, which she was gripping with both hands like it was a steering wheel. She stood up to get a better view. At the center of the room, a black draped pedestal held an ancient marble coffin. This wasn't a church. It was a tomb. Nola turned the iPad again. She knew this place. She'd been here before, during that trip to Afghanistan when she flipped her motorcycle racing the army chaplain, whose eyes were always red like a chili. After her surgery, Nola came here, where so many soldiers had no choice but to sightsee as they waited for flights back to the States. It was called the most beautiful place in Kabul, the Gardens of Babur, with the famous tomb of... What are you doing? A voice barked. Nola spun around. It took a half second to realize it was coming from the iPad. Answer me, the voice shouted again. Already off balance, Nola kept turning. On screen, something moved. Someone. Headed right for her. She saw his legs first. Beige, pale green, and brown camouflage. The old army desert combat uniform from Iraq. She lifted the iPad, finally getting a good look. Her mouth went dry. Like someone was reaching down her throat, pulling her lungs out. That's not possible. But there he was, on screen. The buzzed blonde hair, the lantern jaw, even the pale blue eyes. He was supposed to be dead. What in fuck's name are you doing here? Lieutenant Colonel Archie Mint barked, plowing straight at Nola. 22. Guidry, Texas. 17 years ago. This was Roddy when he was 11. He was raging, his lips curling away from his teeth as he stormed upstairs. And Marie, I know you have it. Gimme my Game Boy, Roddy shouted, referring to the handheld Nintendo he'd spent 6 months saving for. Mowing lawns, washing cars, even going door to door to sell off the old baseball cards he'd stolen from other kids. Roddy, please don't pick a fight, his younger brother Darren pleaded, trailing behind him as they reached the second floor, storming toward the door with a red and white metal sign that read, Danger, teenager inside,
Proceed with caution. The sign was right. Give me the damn Game Boy, you skank, or I'll... Roddy threw open the door, surprised to find... laughter. On the bed, his older sister Anne-Marie was lying on her stomach, feet in the air, twirling her left ankle like a satellite dish. She stared at the Game Boy, giggling. She wasn't the only one. On Roddy's left, in a pink beanbag chair, was a ninth-grade girl with crystal blue eyes, her blonde hair up in the same French braid she'd worn since elementary school. Missy Totino, Anne-Marie's best friend, and the girl Roddy had had a crush on since that sleepover last year when Roddy walked in while Missy was on the toilet. See? He's embarrassed. Told you he loved you, Anne-Marie said to Missy. A.M., Roddy scolded. She's joking, he insisted. So now you don't think she's pretty? Anne-Marie challenged. No, that's not would you kiss her. A.M., Roddy pleaded, the anger gone from his voice. He was begging now, trying to limit the damage. Can I please just have my Game Boy?
Sure,
Anne-Marie grinned. For a trade. Roddy took a half step back, his younger brother already gone, too smart to be part of the collateral damage. Back when Anne-Marie had first started offering trades, they were small. She'd want an extra dessert or to get out of walking the dog. Last year, though, she'd found Roddy's wallet in the back seat of the car and upped the ante, offering to trade it back only if he did her week's chores. From there, Anne-Marie did what the oldest child always does, took advantage of her younger siblings. Today, however, was the first time she'd use it for something sinister. I'll do your work wheel for 2 weeks. You called me a skank. For that alone, 3 weeks, Roddy countered. For a Game Boy? A month, okay? That's my... Anne-Marie, just give him the stupid game, Missy interrupted. Roddy turned. So did Anne-Marie. What did you say? Anne-Marie challenged. A.M., please, Roddy pleaded. Just tell me what you want. For the rest of his life, Roddy would never forget the look on his sister's face, a thin slit that looked like a grin, but carried no joy in it. Take your shirt off.
What?
You think I don't see you doing push-ups before bed? Show Missy your new body. Your shirt. Take it off. Anne-Marie, that's not funny, Missy insisted. You said he was cute. Here's your chance to see him. For a moment, it looked like Missy might argue. But in ninth grade, especially among teenage girls, there's a fine line between outrage and self-preservation. Missy sat there in the beanbag, staring at Roddy. We're waiting, Anne-Marie said, waving the Game Boy. Roddy stood there, his skinny body barely filling his Shrek t-shirt, which was now damp with sweat. In front of him were Anne-Marie and Missy. Behind him, his younger siblings, Darren and now Paulette, were back in the hallway. On any playground, when something bad goes down, no one wants to miss it. I'm counting to three, Anne-Marie said, reaching toward her nightstand for an open can of Diet Coke. She held the can over the Game Boy, ready to pour. One. Don't, Roddy begged. Please. Two. She tipped the can more. Roddy could feel his fists tightening, could feel the bad Roddy poking through, telling him to go for her throat. He'd done it before. On Mother's Day, when Anne-Marie was teasing him for not having a real mom, but all he got was a black eye. Anne-Marie was in high school, 4 years older. He'd be bigger than her soon enough. But not yet. 2¾, Anne-Marie counted. I'm doing it, Roddy said, grabbing the hem of his Shrek t-shirt and giving it a tug. He shut his eyes to make it go faster. All it did was turn the world into slow motion. The air felt frozen as he exposed his stomach. The very worst part was the burn of everyone's stares, slicing him at every angle, cutting deeper as he continued to lift his shirt, revealing his belly button.
Anne-Marie whistled with a catcall. Someone else let out a laugh. At 11 years old, it was the first time in his life that Roddy wished he were dead. It wouldn't be the last.
Oh, does he have a hard-on? Anne-Marie asked.
He didn't. Not that it mattered. Humiliation complete.
It's enough, Anne-Marie. Leave him alone, Missy said.
Suddenly you're feeling bad? Anne-Marie challenged.
Anne-Marie.
You're a shit, Missy added, hopping up from the beanbag and heading for the door. As she blew past Roddy, she crashed into him, sending him bumping into the wall. In the hallway, his siblings scattered.
Does that... Can I have my Game Boy now?
Shirtless Roddy asked. Anne-Marie rolled her eyes and, with a flick of her wrist, chucked the Game Boy toward his feet.
No, don't!
It crashed in that way that electronics aren't meant to crash, the screen shattering.
I'll kill you, Roddy muttered, dropping his shirt and running toward her. I mean it.
No, you won't. Anne-Marie shoved him hard in the chest, sending him tripping over a wastebasket and tumbling to the ground.
Now get the hell out of my room.
She kicked his shirt like a soccer ball. And take your wuss shirt with you. Down on his knees, Roddy picked up his Game Boy, which now wouldn't turn on.
Don't cry. Don't cry. Don't fucking cry, he told himself,
already failing miserably. On this day, Roddy knew better than to fight back. Soon enough, that would change. 23. Today.
You look...
Zig caught himself, stopped, started again, staring at his ex-wife.
Charmaine, is everything okay?
Ziggy, we should do this inside. He knew that tone. He knew all her tones. She got married. That was Zig's first thought. She wouldn't take a half-hour drive unless it was big. Zig was tempted to ask her right there, but knew it would look desperate. They used to speak a few times a year, some texts during birthdays, then by voice on the anniversary of Maggie's death. That had stopped years ago, Charmaine saying it was too much, whatever that meant.
Mr. Zigarowski, you want me to wait?
Roddy called out from his police cruiser. Zig waved him off, shoving open the front door and motioning for Charmaine to enter first. As she brushed past him, he got a better look at her. She looked good. She always looked good, with porcelain skin and pale green eyes the color of palm trees. More important, he took in her smell, a mix of lavender and worn leather. Instantly, a rush of endorphins lit his brain, the kaleidoscope starting to swirl with old memories, all out of order. Their last meal at Patton's, an old Sting concert, the taste of her kiss. That night in the bathtub after her brother's wedding. That night in their car when they were first dating. The red lights of an ambulance. Charmaine screaming in rage, screaming in loss, screaming in agony.
You had a funeral today?
Charmaine said, though it wasn't a question. Zig looked down at his suit. It wasn't his clothing that gave him away. It was the smell. Charmaine hated the stench of embalming fluid. Back at Mint's funeral, he'd scrubbed thoroughly, dousing himself in cologne. But some things can't be masked. It's not... It was a Dover thing.
I thought you were done with Dover,
she countered, no judgment in her voice. Never met a fallen soldier you didn't want to help, huh? This one's different. She made a face. That one she always made when she didn't want to get into it.
I take it this is your handiwork?
Charmaine said, setting her purse down on the antique tiger oak bench, complete with a lift seat that Zig had rebuilt from scratch. Next to it was an English pine coat rack made with 5 vintage railroad spikes that he'd personally pulled from the ground.
You're getting fancy in your old age.
Zig smiled, pretending the compliment didn't matter. But everything with an ex matters. He looked over his handiwork with a fresh eye, imagining how the pieces looked to her. Each project had taken months. He'd built the dining room table from barnwood, reupholstered the arts and crafts style sofa, and personally sandblasted the porcelain on the antique barbershop chair that he'd pulled from a junkyard and made the centerpiece of his living room. He'd even sculpted the three soapstone hummingbirds anchored to the wall above the sofa. Zig was always moving, filling his home with project after homemade project. But at this moment, with Charmaine at the center of it, his house felt emptier than ever. "Restroom this way?" she asked, heading toward the kitchen without hesitation, like she owned the place. "What's the bad news?" Zig called out. "Just relax," she replied, doing that thing where she twisted her wrists, jangling her yoga bracelets, which were made of shells, beads, and pale aquamarine crystals. Heading down the hallway, she forced a smile before disappearing into the bathroom. It fooled most people, but it didn't fool Zig, and he didn't fool her. She definitely got married, Zig thought, racing toward the kitchen, practically smashing his shins into the pinewood bench as he grabbed his laptop from the farm table. With a few clicks, he navigated to Facebook, the browser populating with the only profile he ever visited. Charmaine Clark. Status: in a relationship. Like most things on Facebook, it was a half-truth. Charmaine had gotten engaged months ago. No wedding date set, at least based on the few replies he'd seen on the subject. He double-checked her feed. Her most recent post was a photo that a friend took after a recent car crash, airbag deployed, all the windows shattered, with a message from Charmaine, "Be thankful for what you have." "So true," someone replied. "Love your posts," wrote another, outdoing the caps with triple exclamation points. For years after Maggie's death, Zig would check Facebook every day, eyeing Charmaine's relationship status. He swore it off years ago, on that night that he decided to leave Dover and his old life behind. New house, new town, new start. Yet in 2 minutes, Zig already felt that familiar pit in his stomach, that cocktail of thrill and shame that only comes from being around an old flame. "Sorry to ambush you. It's just... oh boy," Charmaine called out behind him, her voice hoarse, like she'd been yelling or crying. Zig slapped shut his laptop and spun around, getting a better view of her in the light of the kitchen. She still looked great, but she also looked tired. Her crow's feet were deeper than he remembered. Same with her 11s, which was what she called the two vertical wrinkles between her eyebrows. But her brown hair was long again, the way she used to wear it. "She's beautiful," Zig thought, the emotional kaleidoscope spinning faster, anxiety colliding with excitement. "She looks better than last time. She hates me." And of course, that steadfast nugget that always arrived as old memories mixed with old smells, mixed with an entire lifetime that they'd shared and then discarded. "She still loves me." Yet as Zig motioned for her to sit across from him, it was clear that when it came to old love, nothing got discarded. At least not completely. "You and Warren okay?" A small smile lit Charmaine's face. A real one. Back when they were married, Charmaine had taught linguistics at Drexel University, where she'd greet students with her favorite joke. The past, the present, and the future walked into a bar. It was tense. After Maggie's death, though, working with kids, Charmaine couldn't do it. Like most parents who bury a child, she couldn't do much of anything. What saved her was, of all things, yoga. Eventually, she opened Blue Yoga Maya, a small wellness center, determined to be on the giving side of helping others rather than the receiving. The universe heard her loud and clear. A week after the opening, she met Warren. "He's great. Warren's great," she said, a true calm settling her voice, her 11s disappearing. "Is this where you tell me you got married?" Zig asked. "You say that like it's a bad thing." Zig froze. No, not at all. I just meant...
"Joke,"
I was choking, Ziggy. We're engaged, you know that. No wedding date yet. He nodded, trying to laugh it off. I didn't know you moved, Charmaine said. I had to look this place up to find you. The house is nice. It's smaller. But you know, we can't all live in model homes. Charmaine flashed a grin. Another real one. Her fiancé was a general contractor, specializing in model homes in pre-planned communities. Make fun all you want. I know you like Warren. He hated to admit it was true. On the night they first met, bumping into each other at an airport of all places, Charmaine and Warren were heading to Hawaii, Zig to Ohio for a mortician's conference. Zig was ready to put his carry-on bag through Warren's teeth. Instead, a snow delay in Philly gave them 4 hours in an airport bar, screaming at the Eagles game and bonding over who had the best mustache in Philly sports history. Dave the Hammer Schultz, the enforcer, who still held the NHL record for most penalties in a season. That night in the airport, as they hugged goodbye, Zig whispered two words into Charmaine's ear. Keep him. He meant it. Sure, it crushed Zig to see his ex so happy. But the only thing that crushed him more was to see her sad. Warren was decent. He was good to his older daughters, and his model homes were better designed than Zig would have expected. After everything Charmaine had been through, everything she'd lost, she deserved a model home of her own. So if you're not married, why'd you come all this way? Charmaine reached into her handbag. Her hand shot out, slapping a black rectangle the size of a brick against the table. An old videotape. Zig grinned. That's not from that night I need you to look at something, she explained. She didn't have to say another word. Like any long-married couple, they could have entire conversations with nothing more than a glance. He knew that look. This was about their daughter Maggie. Why would just watch, Charmaine said, handing him her phone, her 11s firmly back in place. On screen was a gray circle with a black triangle in it, a video. She'd used her phone's camera to record whatever was on the videotape. You need to see it for yourself, she added. Zig hit play. Then his whole world unraveled. 24. What is this? Zig asked. Just watch, Charmaine said as the video on her phone began to play. On screen was another screen, an outdated television with a familiar silver border. Is that our old... With the built-in VCR, she said. Zig recognized their old TV, the one that used to be in their basement, where Maggie, at barely a year old, held on to the coffee table, eating Cheerios and bouncing to the maddening theme of Thomas the Tank Engine. It's the only VCR I could find. Zig leaned on both elbows, down toward the phone. The video was grainy, showing a teenage girl. Not Maggie. Someone else. Maybe 15 or 16, with jet black hair and shiny lip gloss. She was sitting on a couch facing the camera, like she was being interviewed. Is that? What's her face? She had that dog who bit everyone? Alexis Mayer lived around the corner, babysat for Maggie. But what I really love are Broadway plays, especially musicals, Alexis said on screen, tucking her hair behind her ear. And choreography. I love excellent choreography. Why do we care about this? Zig asked, noticing the sign just above Alexis's head. It was in an 80s Miami Vice font, aquamarine and pink. Superstars, Zig read, old synapses firing as he remembered. Superstars modeling? He blurted. That's the one. It was two towns over. The owner's daughter got booked on a commercial for Sunny Delight or something stupid like that. Back when the girls were little, half of Maggie's friends did tryouts at Superstars with one of these videos. Please tell me you didn't let Maggie... Come on, Charmaine said, pointing him back to the screen, where young Alexis was adamant that Newsies changed her life. Zig was trying to watch,
but what he couldn't unsee was his old TV, its familiar plastic paneling playing tricks with his brain, like he was watching his past, spending a lazy Sunday in bed back when he and Charmaine were first married, binge-watching VH1's Behind the Music long before they called it binge-watching, the two of them betting whether it was the guitarist or drummer who would have the drug problem. God, I remember buying that TV. Circuit City, Charmaine said, still focused on the screen. What matters is, Superstars shut down years ago, once they realized that charging kids $49.99 for headshots that don't work, well, that's just not a long-term business model. Apparently the owner of the place died 6 months back, leaving everything to her daughter, someone named Diane Cash. 2 weeks back, Diane finally started going through her mom's stuff, at which point she found boxes and boxes of old videotapes, Zig said.
Exactly.
At first, she uploaded a few to Facebook, everyone getting a laugh at how they used to look in their Star Search days. And then, as she was going through one of the tapes, Diane saw this and reached out to me. Zig studied the screen. As the girl in the video stood up to say goodbye, the video blurred, the screen filling with horizontal lines that got wider, then smaller, hiccuping with static.
What? To thank,
young Alexis said, her voice warping, everything going black and silver. A thick band of static appeared, then disappeared, revealing a new image, something buried underneath. To make the Alexis video, someone had taped over an older video. Now that older video was playing.
Is that?
Zig knew who it was, even through the static.
His dead daughter, Maggie. She was there, on screen. And she was sobbing.
25.
It's him,
Nola thought. Talk to me, Colonel Mint roared, immediately barking orders, his voice a robotic roar. Who are you? How'd you get here? Nola stumbled backward, crashing into the fold-out desk. Back when she first moved into the trailer, it took months to adjust to the small space, her body eventually gaining the muscle memory to avoid bumping into everything. Now, she hit the desk hard, knocking over a canvas as pencils and paintbrushes rained down. The cat jumped at the sound, scurrying out of sight. On screen, Mint's face, his expressions. The digital image was perfect, right down to the small scar above his eyebrow, as if they'd scanned him in. They even had the gold medallion on his chest, the soldier's medal, awarded for heroism outside of enemy combat. Nola now mentally replaying the story they forced Mint to tell her, of him leaving work and hearing screaming from an elevator. With his bare hands, Mint pried the doors open, finding the elevator trapped between floors. Sliding down through the small gap, he helped rescue the screamer, a severely overweight man who was clearly suffering from a panic attack. Mint shoved him up and out, all 300 pounds of him, though it wasn't until the paramedics arrived that he realized Mr. Panic Attack was the CFO of Huntington Ingalls, one of the country's top federal defense contractors. As Mint used to tease, that's the only reason he got the medal, to make the CFO feel good.
Did you hack this account?
He demanded through the iPad. Nola opened her mouth, but nothing came out.
This isn't. Mint is dead. This can't be him.
We should go, someone shouted. It took a moment to realize it wasn't Mint. Nola turned the iPad again. Someone else was there. Another soldier with darker skin. Hispanic, close-set eyes. His fatigues were also beige, green, and brown, but the darker camouflage was the modern scorpion pattern, the current ones you get in basic training.
Move! Now!
The Hispanic man shouted. Above his head, a beam of blue light shone down. His character began glowing, his body now pixelated, small digital squares of him disappearing like he was being beamed up on Star Trek.
Plink!
The Hispanic man was gone. A second blue beam appeared above Mint.
Sir! Don't!
Nola shouted.
Too late. His body started pixelating.
Sir, she roared. Archie, look at me. That's not you, is it?
Colonel Mint turned and locked eyes with her.
Was it him? It couldn't be.
She went to say something else. Clink. Mint disappeared, leaving Nola standing there, alone in her trailer, staring at a digitized tomb in Afghanistan. The cat trailed, trying to decide whether to approach or not. She stayed under the table. Nola was too busy staring at the screen. Was it a video game? An online hangout? She eyed the photorealistic rendering of the tomb, the Afghan locale now making her wonder if Black House was something created by the military. Did she believe Colonel Mint was suddenly alive? No. She'd seen the crime scene photos. There was no faking that. But whoever was just logged in there with her clearly knew that Mint used this space for something. And it wasn't just for making dinner reservations. Nola turned the iPad slightly, watching the view of the darkened tomb turn with her. Whatever was really going on in this app, in this place called Black House, Archie Mint had an account here, and from the looks of it, was communicating with others here. If that was the case, with the right tools and the right person, whatever Mint was doing could be tracked. Fortunately for Nola, she knew the perfect person for that. 26. Zion Lopez lost his temper too quickly. It would be his downfall. I mean it. Stay back, Zion yelled, swinging an empty vodka bottle like a sword. Stay back! Across from him, in Zion's small but surprisingly well-decorated Japanese living room, complete with a shoji screen, a red-headed woman with different colored eyes, one green, one blue, stepped toward him. She had a buoyant walk and wore a blue leather coat. It was faux leather, actually, since she was vegan. But she was the kind of person who made you feel uncomfortable, who you'd somehow know to walk away from. The kind of person you can feel watching you across a room, even when you're not looking their way. Reagan, you're not listening, Zion yelled, holding the bottle by the neck. He was wrong. Reagan heard every word. It's why, when she first walked into the townhouse, she was so impressed. Young street guys like Zion usually panic and run. A few wet their pants. Zion, a charismatic Dominican kid with a shaved head and trendy chin stubble, invited her inside, offering some sparkling water and a charming lopsided grin. On his coffee table was a stack of Simon Sinek business books. Zion was a pro, quickly trying to make a deal. Maybe there's something I can help you with. There wasn't. But how could she not admire ambition like that? Reagan was a professional, first and foremost. She took pride in her work. Whatever the job, do it best. Like her father taught her.
Reagan, step the hell back. It wasn't me, Zion shouted with another swing of the vodka bottle as he backed up toward the kitchen. Ask anyone. I wasn't there, Reagan, he insisted, thinking he was smart to call her by her first name. Keep it personal. If he were really smart, he'd have known that the only reason Reagan used her real name was because she had no intention of Zion ever speaking to anyone again. I heard you met Mr. Vess when you were 12, Reagan said, moving slowly, unafraid, her hands shifting in her pockets like she was knitting with invisible needles. On the dining room table, she spotted a butter-colored wooden bowl that was the exact same shade of yellow as an old 1960 guitar, a Les Paul special that she'd tried to bid on a few months back. According to the auction house, it supposedly belonged to reggae legend Peter Tosh. His name was engraved on the truss cover, a solid 8 out of 10. She shouldn't have let it get away.
Reagan, I swear on my mother's life, I would never...
They told me you used to play on one of Mr. Vess's youth basketball teams. That's real history, Reagan pointed out, still thinking about the guitar. See, you can imagine how upset he was to find out you were the one who—
It wasn't me! For the 95th time, Zion screamed, spit flying, his fuse fully lit.
He started to turn toward the kitchen. Zion, if you run— Too late. He was gone, the vodka bottle still in hand as he bolted through the kitchen, heading for the back door. Reagan rolled her eyes. Zion tore open the door and darted outside, where he collided with the chest of the massive man in a black windbreaker who was waiting for him. The man held up a plastic Walmart bag that he'd fished out of Zion's trash. In the bag was a receipt and a box for a latex Oscar the Grouch mask. Today's show is sponsored by the letter M. For moron, Reagan said as her partner shoved Zion inside. I see you met Seabass. Sebastian, meet Zion. Zion looked up, noticing Sebastian's sad blue eyes and heart-shaped face. He was vast, was the only word to describe him, his chest wide like an iceberg. Up top, he had bright red. Zion froze. She and he. They both red hair. Now it made sense. Professionally, they were called the Reds. Reagan was an auburn redhead with alabaster skin. Sebastian was freckled and ruddy, pure Irish. According to some, they were husband and wife. Others said brother and sister. Neither was true, though the rumors only intensified when people noticed that Sebastian didn't speak. Some said he was mute. Others that it was from a Humvee accident in Yemen. He was an army ranger, and a shard of metal sliced into his throat. The most absurd theory was also the most popular, that he'd done it to himself in some sacred vow of silence. The truth was, Seabass was simply quiet, a natural observer who preferred letting his thoughts marinate. Besides, Reagan talked enough for both of them. All the other rumors were nonsense, or as Reagan called it, marketing. It was the same with their name, the Reds. Short, catchy, easy to remember. Even in a business like theirs, marketing mattered. As for why they worked as a team, why does anyone work as a team? They were better together. At it for so long now, they moved as one. Get back, Zion yelled, raising the vodka bottle like a bat. He never had a chance. With a hand like a manhole cover, Seabass rammed his palm into Zion's nose, breaking it with a crack. Blood splattered like juice from a popped cherry. Zion stumbled, wobbling, letting go of the vodka bottle, which smashed at his feet, glass scattering across the kitchen. I need him conscious, Reagan announced. Seabass made a face, like we've never done this before. Wrapping his tree trunk arms around Zion, Seabass bear hugged the kid, pulling him against his chest and squeezing the air from his lungs. Unable to breathe, Zion raised his chin, his neck now exposed. That was all Reagan needed. From her pocket, she pulled out what looked like piano wire, though it was really a thin chain with tiny metal teeth, a camping tool from Reagan's favorite days when she was little, back before her dad's arrest, when he used to take her on hunting trips. With a metal ring at each end, the mini saw was perfect for slicing branches and firewood, too thin for bone or ticking off a ram's horn. Boy, did it tear through flesh. In one quick movement, like she was doing Cat's Cradle, Reagan looped the saw around Zion's exposed neck, pulling it tight against his skin. Zion, we know you're the one who shot Archie Mint. In a dumb rage, you also shot a valet named Anthony Wojewicz. So, choose your next words very carefully, Reagan explained, tugging harder on the thin saw, letting it dig into Zion's Adam's apple. I need to know who hired you. 27. The Globus was back. That was the doctor's word for it. The lump in Zig's throat, like a stuck pill,
that Zig had for a full year after Maggie's death. It made it hard to breathe, even harder to sleep. Someone called it a grief lump, affecting those who have been through wrenching despair. Whatever it was, one day, Zig woke up and it was gone. Now, at just the sight of this video, of Maggie at 12 years old, right before she died, the Globus was back, wedged in his windpipe. His head was buzzing, like he'd lost a minute of time. He looked around. He was somehow standing in his kitchen, one leg propped on the bench, though he had no memory of getting up. Why is she crying? He asked, already crying himself. Across from him, still sitting, Charmaine shook her head, tears in her own eyes. She had no idea. The phone screen went black with a final burst of static. The end. That's it? Zig asked. Where's the rest? Charmaine shook her head again. She looked gutted, her shoulders sagging. Grabbing the phone and swiping his finger, Zig rewound the video, back to where Maggie first appeared. There was a loud, warped sound, loads of static. And then, there she was. Magpie, Zig whispered, not even realizing he'd said it. On screen, Maggie's head was down, her hands clutching her face, like she was trying to hide. Even as a kid, Maggie wasn't a crier. At 3 years old, while spinning in circles outside the local ice cream shop, she'd tripped and landed on her wrist. She went quiet, dead silent, but never shed a tear. A woman who saw it happen said she'd probably just sprained it, but Zig suspected otherwise. To test his theory, he held up Maggie's favorite lovey, a plush purple monkey named Banana, directly in front of her. When Maggie refused to reach for it, he knew something was wrong. Sure enough, Maggie had broken her wrist in 3 places. She's tough, the nurse in the emergency room said. A little bag of nails. In the years after her death, Zig carried that around with him. Little bag of nails. Tonight, though, every detail that he carried was gone, like it had been ripped away.
I'm sorry. So sorry,
his young daughter whispered on screen, her body convulsing, shaking. At just the sight of her, the Globus expanded in Zig's throat. On the right-hand side of the screen, someone's hand appeared in shadow, giving her a tissue. Maggie took it, wiped her eyes.
You don't have to. They don't even know.
She blew her nose, never looking up.
I should have. I'm sorry to drag you into.
The static swallowed her whole. That was it. The end. Zig scrolled the video back again.
I'm sorry to drag you into.
Into what? Zig asked. Who's she talking to? Charmaine sat there, silent. Zig replayed it again.
I'm sorry to drag you into.
Zig put 2 fingers on the screen, expanding the image. As Maggie wiped her eyes with the back of her hand, he spotted a smudge of mascara on her knuckle. This was after she started wearing makeup. 12 years old, for sure. Right before she died.
I'm sorry to drag you into.
He played it again. And again.
I'm sorry to drag you into.
She sounds like. You think she was. Was someone hurting her? Zig asked, the words tumbling from his lips, everything moving hyper-fast and hyper-slow at the same time. Charmaine was crying now, head down, picking at the leather strap on one of her bracelets. The talent agency.
The daughter of the owner. I asked her. Begged her. This was all she could find,
Charmaine muttered.
She said there were no records of Maggie ever being a client.
Zig rewound the video and played it again. Then, again. 17 seconds of his dead daughter sobbing. The hitch in her voice. The pain. An old swirling hole opened in Zig's stomach. The one that took him back to the old funeral home. To Maggie. Her tiny gray corpse lying there in the mortuary. Zig determined to prep her body. To wash her hair and put her in her best dress. To take care of her one last time. And then crumpling to his knees, unable to stand, unable to breathe,
unable even to cry, his entire body collapsing in on itself, a river of snot running down his nose as he realized that when it came to prepping his own daughter's body, he couldn't. "Ziggy, please say something," Charmaine pleaded. He was still staring at the screen. Why would... The way she's... Who is she even talking to anyway? And why go to them instead of us? Did she think we wouldn't listen? Or is it... Zig squinted at the screen. This person. He looks like a man. It's definitely a man. He looked up at his ex, the rage in her eyes catching him off guard. You do realize, Char, this is much easier when you're the calm one and I'm the one in the mad rage. Ziggy, whatever's going on in that video. This is our girl, she said, the words stinging Zig's chest. You can call Wags. You can call Dover. Hell, you can call every damn government operative you've met in the last 2 decades who owes you a favor. Someone should be able to find tax records for this rinky-dink superstar's talent agency. And if there are tax records, there'll be an employee list. I need to know who was speaking to our daughter. Even if this was just her being a 12-year-old girl, mad that some friend didn't invite her for a sleepover or whatever the hell it was. I want to know who she was talking to. So go do what you do best and be a pain in the ass. Zig sat up straight. Pain in the ass? I was saying it with love. Make it happen. And I pretend buy you the Back to the Future car. Charmaine froze as she said the words. She physically touched her own lips, like she was trying to put the sentence back in her mouth. Years ago, when she and Zig had first gotten married and money was tight, they'd make pretend purchases for each other. I pretend buy you tickets to the Phillies World Series. In no time, it became their inside joke. I pretend buy you these 14 Yorkie puppies in this pet store window. It escalated from there. I pretend buy you doormats with obscenities on them that we would never display in public. Only if I can pretend buy you that historic house we saw in Missouri with the jail on the back of it. Needless to say, after the divorce, the pretend buying stopped. Until this exact moment, when Charmaine accidentally let one slip out. Just do me a favor, Ziggy, and find out what the hell's going on. He nodded and grabbed the videotape. Then his phone, already dialing. Even with records this old, there's always a trail to follow. Fortunately for Zig, he knew the perfect person for that.